The game is on the line, and I've only got a shot clock's worth of time to tell you about Subway's $6.99 footlong deal. That's right. Order now in the Subway app and get any footlong on the menu for just $6.99. Fresh sliced deli meat, fresh crispy veggies. Ah, too much good stuff. Get it now on the Subway app. Any footlong for just $6.99. Use code 699FL now. Only here for a limited time. Redeemable at participating U.S. restaurants. Subway app, online orders only. Add-ons, additional plus tax. Additional fees apply on delivery. Excludes footlong snacks. Limited time.
Welcome to the Psychovertical podcast. It's me, Andy Kirkpatrick. Still in Spain. I'm travelling around. I'm in Granada at the moment, in the mountains of Granada. So I'm like, oh God, I'm in Granada. In the mountains of Granada, which is quite cool. Actually, it's quite cold. I hate those things, you know, when people are going around the world for a year, like Leo Holding's currently going around the world with his kids, and they always have like, oh, just skiing in Japan, loving life, and then it's like in Thailand on this beach, you know, living the dream and all that kind of stuff. It's like, oh, fuck off. Like, it's just so annoying, isn't it? Like, people like that. It's just fucking keep it to yourself. And I don't want you to think there's like if you can hear it, there's a crying baby in the background. You can hear the nature. Can you hear it? You usually can hear like a chainsaw, like in the background. But no, there's no chainsaws here. I'm actually staying somewhere where there's a... it's one of those houses where you can't use toilet roll. Sorry. I'm on my podcast. I'm talking to my podcast ears. It's one of those. I remember the first time I went to Patagonia, and we stayed in this hostel, and you couldn't have a, when you had a crap, you couldn't like put your toilet roll in the toilet. You had to put it in this little bin next to it. I remember thinking like, what fuck, this is like mental. Like, what kind of third world hellhole is this? And yeah, it takes quite a lot of you know, but the where I'm staying here is the same. So it's a septic tank. Like, we have a septic tank where we live. Our house has got a septic tank in Ireland. And someone said, if you ever have any problems with your septic tank, all you have to do is put a chicken in it. And I think I'm thinking he meant like a dead chicken, and that'll sort it out. So don't know how that works. Usually we just get someone to come and like pump it all out. I mean, I've told this story before. You know, when the guy comes to like pump all the shit out of your septic tank, like, you never shake his hand. He's never, oh, cheers, mate, thanks for coming. He's like, oh yeah, cheers, mate, like putting your hands behind your head. So it's a shit job. Someone's got to do it. So still traveling around. Been doing some walking. I've been testing out a tump line. Now, not a trump line, no, never tumper. I'm never a trump line, which is a strap that goes from your pack. Now, it's various places where it could come from your pack. And then it goes up around your forehead or the top of your head. So the weight is hanging off your, basically, instead of hanging off your shoulders, it's like hanging off your head. So it's kind of what Sherpas, you know, by porters and, you know, primitive people, how they carry stuff. And I think I once had a pizza with Yvonne Chouinard, and he was telling me about the tump line and how cool it was. We said the only problem was you can't see anything. You're just looking at your feet the whole time. So I think the last trip to Yosemite, there was so much carrying stuff around. I was just like, oh God, I've got to find a better way of doing this. Like, I think, I don't know if my aged body has had enough of it, but it's just like grueling. Unfortunately, I've got like my whole bag hasn't got like the best straps on it. It's a Motolius whole bag, but the straps are very flimsy. And I've lost the belt, and I always forget to make a new one. So I always end up there with no hip belt and this huge, heavy thing. I've also lost like the top tension strap, so I've basically done it to myself. But Yeah, so I was like, there must be a better way of doing this. So I kind of revisited this like tump line thing. So I made one, which is just like a strap, and on one section it goes from being like 25 mil webbing to like a broad strap that goes over your head to like spread the load a bit. And I used that kind of like 3D mesh material, that seems to work quite well. Like how they make harnesses these days, similar material. And so I've been using it with my daughter in a backpack. So the my daughter and all the other stuff that goes in your backpack, like carrying it around. So she's two and a bit. So I don't know how heavy she is. She's feels pretty heavy if you're carrying a child all day long. So to begin with, as soon as I started using it, like I really thought, like, wow, this actually does make like a huge difference. And you end up having, like, apparently it reduces the perceived load by a third. And you've basically got, like, some of the load on your shoulders and then some of the load on your head. And as you lean forward, the weight goes more onto your head. So it's in line with your spine, like carrying it on the top of your head. And so you can go from having like really sore shoulders from carrying this load, and you suddenly like you tighten up the strap a little bit and lean forward a bit, so so you transfer some of the load onto your head, and suddenly like the pain just like disappears. Now if you're doing it for a long time, the pain starts coming back, but in your neck. So you have to like slowly build up your neck muscles and just how you basically use it. You can sort of like divide the load up between your head, your shoulders, and your knees and toes. Now your head, your shoulders, and your hip belt. But generally, I tend to like stop using the hip belt. I just find the hip belts like a bit restrictive, and just go on the shoulder straps and the thing. So I think in the olden days they used to have a strap that went over your head, and then they'd have a strap that went around like the front of your, like going across your chest, like a wide strap across your chest, which probably works quite well. As you move your arms, the weight would be going onto your chest and your arms, but not onto your shoulders. So it would be interesting to try that. But so it worked very well. I think if I was going to do it with some heavier weight, I think I might modify a rucksack, because at the moment the strap is just goes down from my head, and it just is like sort of wrapped, it's kind of like hooked underneath the bottom of the pack. And I'm told that the best place for it to come off is, if you imagine where your ice axe loops are on a pack, you know, like just that kind of seam down there, like at the bottom. So it's coming off the back corner, the back outside base of the pack, and then coming upwards up into your neck and head. But some of the main people who use these packs, like leisure type people, are canoeists who do a lot of portaging around, which when you're on a canoe or a kayak, you don't really travel very light, you just take everything. So they use them quite a lot. And most of those packs, there's an attachment point around the height of your shoulder blades on the pack, so the strap is coming up much higher on the pack and then over your head. But yeah, I think it would be a real game changer for I hate that word. And it'd be really useful for anything where you've got a lot of weight around. So you know, things like Denali or big Himalayan things, we have to like transport a lot of weight, like big wall stuff especially, transfer a lot of weight around. I think it'd be really, really good. So I shall endeavour to do it. I did like a big long walk with it. I think when you're going downhill, you don't want to wear it when you're going downhill, because when you're going downhill, there's actually quite a lot of force, like you're like boom, 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 and it actually creates quite a lot of like sort of like energy is going through your neck, which isn't very good. So when you're going downhill, you can just go back onto your shoulder straps. But I did like a big walk, and came back, and kids all went for a nap, and I went for a nap. And I was laying there, I suddenly felt like my head weighed like about 50 kilos or something. I don't know. But it felt like really, really heavy, and it was just because my neck, I think, was so tired from the weight of it. So yeah, interesting bit of technology there for you. I was thinking about, I'll keep doing it. I'm always on like money making schemes, so I might actually. I was thinking of, because I've been Googling trying to buy them, and it seems actually not very easy to buy one. I was thinking of maybe doing like a Kickstarter, like get someone to make some. I think you'd have to make two types. I think you have to make one that was just a strap that would go on anything, and then one that would just be the. You'd probably have to have something where you just sew the tabs onto your existing rucksack. Like you wouldn't use it for like an alpine rucksack. You'd only be using it for like a big monster rucksack. So I don't know how many people do that, carry big rucksacks these days. It doesn't seem to be that big a thing. Everyone wants to be up and down in a day. So I was thinking you could do like a Kickstarter. And do like a anyway. So this podcast is, I had like two interesting questions. Well, one was a question, but it was like a very long email about an epic on a mountain, and the other one was about how to control your ropes in like really windy, horrible conditions. So I'll do that. I'll do that one first. I think Jim Bridwell said, on a belay there's always chaos or something. And I think like the same is probably true when it comes to ropes. So, a quick drink of tea. I think I went through like a great deal of my life just dealing with ropes, being all tangled up all the time and not really, and just seeing it as part of the, you know, how these things went, really. You know, whenever I untangled, and whenever I got to the bottom of a route, my ropes would always be like you'd make them in a big pile, and they'd all be knotted, and I'd be unknotting them, and when I was on a route, you know, they'd just kind of like hank them up something, you know, loop them over something, they'd all be getting tangled up. And although that's not great, you do actually get really good at dealing with ropes that are all tangled up and in a mess. And you're always 6 inches away from total disaster. You know, you're kind of undoing the knots and all the tangles, just as you're at the speed of the leader, really. But I think eventually I probably realized that wasn't a good idea. I think when I started climbing in Yosemite, suddenly you had like in Yosemite you get like a very high winds like in the afternoon. And that's probably one reason why a lot of people bail off the nose, because this wind comes along and the ropes just start flying everywhere and tangling up. And, you know, often you might be on a wall. And I think we did the Pacific Ocean wall. You're up there in the middle of nowhere and you look down and there's like just one flake, really sharp flake out in the middle of nowhere on this wall. And you see like this part of a rope is just hanging off it, that someone must have got the rope tangled up on it and then just had to cut it because it was no way you could get to it. So suddenly you learn the importance of using like rope bags, which I think on my first trip we did actually have proper rope bags. We had like A5 rope bags, which are really, really cool A5 rope bags. I retained one of them for like years and years and years and years. Then one day Vanessa was like, oh, I got rid of that rope bag. It was all tatty and old. And I was like, no, it's a vintage rope bag anyway. So that's gone. So and rope bags, you don't have to be fancy pants rope bags. Like Black Diamond make rope bags, Metolius make rope bags, various people make rope bags. But you don't want one that's like super, super heavy. Like I've got a rope bag that's an Igui rope bag that they never actually made them, but you probably would make you one, and it's big enough for quite a lot of rope. You can probably get like a 100 meters of rope in it. So it's quite a big rope bag with a zipper on it. So you like zip it open and you can, it like opens up, so you can put all your rope in and zip it back closed again. And then, but it's got like two straps on it, two webbing straps, so you can carry it like a rucksack. So it's quite a handy thing to have for, you know, carrying stuff down when you're like getting your route sorted or whatever, like a little pack and stuff. So yeah, so some rope bags are very complicated and advanced and, you know, heavy duty, and some are very lightweight. Like Petzl probably make some very heavy duty bags, ropes for like industrial use. Or you can just use like plastic bag, you know, one of those bag for life shopping bags, that would work totally fine. You know, just a big stuff sack, you know, any whatever you have, you'll probably get it to, you know, get it to work. But generally when you're on a big wall, for example, is it's probably like being on a yacht or something. Like you're always, your job as the leader is to get everything ship shape. You know, when you're the B layer, you know, you get to the B layer, you're hauling, you know, all that kind of stuff, is you generally have to get control of your ropes all times. Like you can never relax until everything, all the ropes are sorted out. And that could mean either they've got to be stacked, put away into the rope bags, or they have to be, ropes have to be sort of coiled up or looped onto something. Sometimes you carry like more than two rope bags. You might have like two or three rope bags, because you've also got, generally you've got your zip line, tag line, which is like a thin rope. But also when you're sending the gear up for the person to set up the belay, you might want to have like a spare rope to go up with that. So when the person's hauling the haul bag, they can start stacking the rope back into the bag. So so keeping control of your ropes is vital. Like anyone who goes to do the nose and doesn't have a rope bag or two rope bags, they're it's like really silly, really. So and then rope bags are good when you're abseiling as well. If you're doing abseiling, if you're somewhere where it's very adventurous and there's lots of trees and bushes or looseness, like a rope bag can really come in really handy, both for climbing but also when you're abseiling, because you can stack the rope away in the rope bag and abseil down with the rope feeding out of it. So it's very handy. And also like totally necessary for soloing, like rope soloing. You just can't do it without rope bags. It's like saying you're gonna go parachuting without having anything to put your parachute in. It doesn't really work. So as for alpine climbing, multi-pitch rock climbing, sea cliff climbing, people don't use rope bags, and they you just have to come up with a good system. Like if you're swinging leads, then generally when you're sort of sorting out your rope or storing the rope ready, preparing it to be used for the next pitch, it's a little bit easier because the rope is going to feed out in the direction it fed in. So, you know, the last meter when you're belaying the second up and you're like making onto a, you know, looping it, means that that's going to be the first meter that leaves. And generally, I think it's best to keep, if you're creating loops, you know, so say you've got a cordelette or say you've got a sling or whatever, is you're, you know, you're putting loops of the rope through this, you know, you're looping it, taking in the slack, looping it, you know, that kind of thing. It's generally, I like to keep the loops above my feet. So I don't want to have like really, really, really massive loops. Like the longer the loops, the less loops you have, but the more chance is they're going to blow around and get tangled or get caught on something or feed into a crack or get in the way of the person who's climbing up below you. So I think having like shorter loops is, you know, like so loops which are like a meter and a half long as they're going through, you know, meter and a half through, it's good. And you can be fancy and you can try and make each loop smaller. So you know, so say if you were taking in two ropes, like two, you have to really you're going to have to loop them together. You can't really separate them very easily. It's too complicated. So you would make your first loop, you know, like 3 meters long. So it would be hanging underneath, further underneath you. Then you would make the next loop 2.75 meters long, and then the next loop would be 2.5 meters long. So each loop is shorter than the loop before it. And towards the end, unless you're very good, you probably end up getting them out to be together. But it means that as each loop is feeding out, when you're building the B layer, it can't get tangled onto the loop underneath it, because that loop is longer, it's hanging down further down. So that's, you know, that's a, like, in theory it works, but you just have to, you know, sometimes you're best just to put up with a little bit of fiddling. Like, if the loops are all the same length, yes, some are going to get tangled on the other one, but usually if you just pull them out, both loops will come out at the same time and you'll be able to work it out. So the other technique is where you, like, knot the rope. So you would you're bringing up the second, and you're taking, you know, a load of rope, and then you tie off with an overhand knot. So you've got two ropes together. So you tie it off an overhand knot, and it gives you an overhand knot with two bites, because it's formed out of two ropes. Now you just clip one of those bites into a carabiner, like a big carabiner, like an HMS or something. Or you just tie off those two ropes, you tie a bite around the cordelette or the sling nearest you. So you're tying the rope directly, capturing the sling or the cordelette with the rope. Does that make any sense? So you make a bite with two ropes, pass the bite around the sling, tie it off with an overhand knot. You just, like, you know, so it's like captured inside. And then when you get the next piece of rope, you do the same. Next rope, you just keep tying it off. And on, if you have like a 60 meter rope, you'll probably find, depending on how many times you tie the rope off, you'll probably take up the whole arm of a cordelette or something. And the alternative is you just clip those bites into a carabiner. You can also, it doesn't work so well with two ropes. If you only have one rope, you can tie like a slip knot. So it means that as soon as you unclip the knot from the carabiner, the rope will, you know, will come away. So if you're not swinging leads, then what you would do is you would tie those knots, but you would tie them in reverse. But at the end you want to tie them into a carabiner, and when it comes to you go from belaying to leading, you just flip the carabiner around. So it means the first knot came on, which would be the last knot to come undone if you were belaying somebody. Becomes the first knot that comes off. So that's a quite a good system. But with all these, if it's like super windy, super spindrify, you know, various issues, then none of them are like foolproof. You're always going to have, you know, some sort of problem occurring probably. So one thing I don't know why people have never do it, but I always think you could make a very lightweight, like, rope bag, just a bag with nothing, just a clipping point, and you could make it out of something like Cuban cloth. I mean, you don't know what Cuban cloth is, but it basically, it's like a crisp packet material, but it weighs the same as a crisp packet material, but it's Dyneema, so it's like really, really strong. But you could make like a big bag like that, and it would pack down small enough to just go in your pocket. You just scrumple it all up and put it in your pocket. And I think that would be really good if you were challenged, belay challenge, really. So I don't know if that answers your question. In Patagonia, you know, you do have some horrendous descents where the wind, when the weather's bad, and the rope is like going upwards, like, you know, there's no like chucking the rope down. The rope is like going up into the air, so you really need to have some sort of system of keeping the ropes, and a bag would be sort of ideal. Otherwise you have to sort of like loop it on slings. You have a rope on either side of your harness, and you just kind of slowly feed the rope out. But it's just the nature of ropes is that they're tanglesome and they're troublesome. So you just have to get used to it, really. So the other thing, I had a very long email about someone climbing a mountain with a big group, and it was like winter time. I won't say where it was, but it was like winter, and it was kind of full on conditions. I think this person wasn't like super experienced. He was with some more experienced people, but it ended up being like a real epic where the person who was the most experienced ended up like barely and going down because it didn't feel very well, and the rest of them carried on, and it was like white out conditions where you can only see like 2 meters ahead. And then some of them wanted to go down, some wanted to go up, and this person was managing to sort of navigate probably, you know, even though he was the only person, he said, who his goggles went steamed up. So he was managing to navigate, and I think he had like a, I think he might have used his phone or something at one point to find out where they were or something. But eventually they got to the summit, and it was just like, you know, apocalyptic conditions. And then this Mount Washington, they managed, there's like a road that goes down Mount Washington, which is quite handy. So they decided to go down this road, and he said even then, like, there was markers, you know, like ones going down the road, and sometimes they couldn't even see the next one. And anyway, it's a great epic. And I think I don't know if he was asking for advice or just like, you know, like this is what happened to me, him. But some of my thoughts about it was, one was the problems of like big teams. Like, I know I've mentioned it before, but like Stalin's saying of like no people, no problem, is definitely applies to, is even if you go on a, you know, like on a family reunion, and there's all these like all these people, and suddenly trying to organize anything or, you know, to do anything, you know, like people just really complicate everything. Like, you often will end up doing, you know, like this psychological thing where, you know, you have 8 people and trying to decide what to do, and they end up doing what nobody wants to do because no one just says, I don't want to do this, you know. So everyone goes along because they think everybody else wants to do it, but nobody wants to do it. So I'm often a big fan of like, well, I'm going to do this. And if if you're staying somewhere, it's like, well, I'm doing this. If you want to do it with me, fine. But if not, I'll see you back here. And, you know, like trying to get everyone to do something at the same time is like really, really, you know, that's why like a picnic is quite good. It's like, I'm just going to go and sit in a field on a blanket. You know, like that's fairly easy to do. But if you're like going to go bullfighting or something, you know, not everyone wants to go bullfighting, do they? So like big teams of people in the mountains, like bigger than 3, is always trouble, because, and especially if you could be like the best, the most fittest, most experienced, best equipped person on that team, but you're only as good as the person who's didn't bring the right gear and has got blisters and is not very fit and just, you know, it's just a liability. And I've been on a few trips with people where they really were like a total liability. They were like, you know, I'd say they put your life at risk, really. And so the more, you know, the generally, if you have more than 3 people, one of them's going to be trouble. You know, 3's a crowd, 4's a crowd. You know, 3's a crowd, but 4's like one of them's mental. That's a good saying. And if you expand, if you double that into 8 people, you know, then you're going to have you know, and often when there's four people, one person sort of becomes the butt of the joke or something. I don't know why that is. So, you know, unless you're really, really good friends, you know, four is not a good number, five is not a good number, six is not, you know, it's just, it's not a very, not very good. So ideally, I think that the ideal, if you have to do stuff with bigger groups of people, maybe you're better to have team, like, subdivide it into smaller units. So each person has like a partner, so you partner up with somebody. Now if someone's not experienced, now that person should be partnered with somebody who is experienced, if you know, that kind of makes sense. You don't want like two experienced people partner together, because that's just going to be a liability for everybody. Now those two people who've made that that partnership, like, they need to partner up with like two other people to make like a four person sort of unit, really. And ideally you'd have like, you know, you'd have like three experienced person to one inexperienced person in that team. And then those four people are going to like link, are going to make a group of eight people. Now here you could have like two, you know, some, one of the, that group of four, you could be like, those people are a bit older and not as fit, or, you know, but they're taking along someone who's not experienced. But you can basically, you could set out as a group of eight, and halfway up it's like the B group, you know, they can be like, they're going too slowly, so the A group are going to keep on going, and that B group can just go at their own pace, and maybe if they don't want to, and then suddenly if the B group, after a few hours, they're like, we're not going to make it, and the other's like, I think we will make it, well, they can split into another group of two, and two can go down and two can go up. And as long as like two people together, you just don't, the worst case thing to happen is that the two experienced people are left to go on by themselves or go down by themselves. So you always need to be like, you know, unless you're just on a solo mission, you always want to stick together. Now each team of people, each pair of people, they have to be totally self-sufficient. So you don't want to be, half the team has got a GPS and a compass and the map, and the other team, you know, the other group don't, or whatever. Like everybody, ideally every single person needs to have all their stuff. So yeah, Vanessa, it's raining. It's raining. Are your clothes all going to get wet? Okay. And are they all wet?
No, but they were wet anyway.
All right. Sorry, apologise for that interruption. It's raining. So so each individual person is their own, you know, their own unit, if you know what I mean. Like they have all the food they need, all their communications they need, all their clothing they need, and their navigation they can need. Now they might not be able to use all these things, but they kind of need to have them, because even if you're inexperienced with someone who's very experienced, you shouldn't allow yourself to get into the position of being like the lesser, you know, just going along, just being like guided up something. You know, you want to be learning from somebody, so you want to be getting out your own compass and your own map and your own, looking at your own watch, and you know, unless you just want to be like, you know, like a passenger up there, you want to be that's one reason why it's often good if you've got some experience to link up with someone who's got no experience, because then you might prove to yourself that you are, you know, what level your experience is at, really, that you can navigate. I was saying to Vanessa, sat here on a swing and on her phone, whenever we go in the mountains, it was like joke to Vanessa, because I'm like, she's be looking on her phone some tracking. I'm always complaining we don't have a map wherever we go. I'm always like, we need a map, and we never have a map. I was like trying to look at some app on a phone where you just can't see anything. I think my eyesight's going. And then I'm always, she's always like, I think if we go down here, this is, I'm like, Vanessa, you've got a map. Just look at the map. It'll tell you where you can. Yeah, but I think it's probably, just look at the map. It'll tell you how far it is or what, where it goes. So the other day we went up on this walk and we went up this like small mountain, and then we came down the other side and we had to go down a gorge, like a sort of scrambly gorge thing. So I was ahead because I had my trump line on my head. So I was like, you know, going along. And then when I got to the entrance to this thing, like Vanessa just didn't turn up. I'm just like sitting there with this like child, 2-year-old, and I've got no nappies, I've got no food, I've got no water, I've got nothing. Like Vanessa had everything. And I was like, and then I'm like, I bet she's got lost. She's got I bet she's lost somewhere. And no sign of her coming down this trail. Everyone who came down was like, excusez-moi, even though I was in Spain. I was like, excusez-moi, un petit poulet, the Irish woman. I kept asking if they'd seen like a woman and a small boy, and they hadn't. So anyway, like after about an hour thinking that she must have died and fallen off the side of the mountain or something, I see her on the opposite side of the mountain, like coming down completely the wrong side of the mountain. Anyway, she'd gone her own, you know. Usually, I think if you're going down a mountain, she goes, if you're like a drop of water, like following, you know, like dribbling down the mountain to the bottom, where Vanessa had gone up the mountain, down one mountain, then up another mountain, just to add some fun to it. So anyway, but it made me think, like, it's so daft that we're up here with I don't have anything, any food or water or anything. So Vanessa had everything. So it's a good lesson when you're in the hills. So teams are one thing. That's why it's good. That's why finding a good partner, like my wife, like having a good partner is really really important, because you're on the same wavelength. You tend not to have to discuss things or argue or anything, or you tend to trust each other. You know, you have like a kind of organic, you know, like a decision making thing. I don't know if this is of any relevance, but if you say you get someone and they can, this is like something from like 19, pre First World War kind of army manual kind of thing. For some reason, I was once doing loads of like gardening, and the only free audiobooks I could find were like all these books that were out of copyright, and one of them was like British Army Manual 1915 or something, or 1912 or something. Anyway, but in it, I had this interesting thing that, say you've got someone who's really good at judging distance, so you say like, Trooper Kirkpatrick, see that tree, see that German over there, you know, how far is it if you're going to shoot him? And you're like, 500 leagues or something, you know. But if you get like 10 people and you ask them how far it is and you average it out, generally that person is more accurate than the person who's really good at judging. So so when you have a really good team of people, it could be like 2 people, it could be 3 people, and I think there's something where you kind of average everything out. You average out the risk and the reward and the work and everything else, and then that's why teams of three are really good for like mountaineering. You know, you average out the stress and everything else. I think you make like quite good decisions when there's 3 of you, better than when there's 2 of you. And definitely when there's only one of you, when there's only one experienced person and they make all decisions and everything else, then that is that's probably like can be like trouble. It's good if everything works out, but if it doesn't work out, it's not so good. So the other aspect of this thing was being in, I don't know if everybody's had this situation where you feel in incredibly hostile weather, and also you're not entirely sure, you know what mountain you're on, but you have no idea really. You think you know where you are on this mountain, but it's a total whiteout. You can hardly see anything, and you feel like you're on the edge of getting like hypothermia and you're tired, and you, the only reason you're carrying on is you're going uphill, so you know you're going towards the top. But if you were to go downhill could get you anywhere. So you're just kind of questing along, and you're on the, it's almost like a claustrophobia, but the opposite of agoraphobic kind of, you're sort of trapped in your goggles, in your shell and everything else, and the weather's so bad that you don't really want to look at your map, or if you try and look, you know, often if it's dark you try to look on your map, but your head touch doesn't seem to be working very well, and your head, you're trying to use a compass with your big gloves on is not easy, and you know, you try and get your phone out to look at something and your phone's dead, or it just gets, you know, full of snow or ice, or it's wet or something. So it's just like the worst case sort of situation to be in. So I think it's important to be dressed right in those situations. You don't want to be too hot, you don't want to be too cold, and you want to be able to dress so you're not like pressured to move too quickly or so hot or something that your goggles are steaming up and everything else. So you want to be like almost like a spaceman, space person, and you feel like you can operate in those conditions. Like I remember I once took some baghouse designers up in Scotland, like up in the hills. And one of them was like, oh, I never really understood why you had wire in a hood before. Like, these are the people who were like making clothing, designing clothing for a baghouse, but they didn't really understand why you have a wire in a hood. So something like a wired hood in those conditions can be like a real lifesaver, you know, something simple like that. Having like a really good, you know, if you're like a roughy tufty climber, you don't really think about map cases and all that kind of stuff, but having a really good system for your map case, so it doesn't blow away, knowing how to use a compass, and it's always good if you go on the hill with someone who's like an orienteer, because they're just like brilliant with a compass. I think that kind of, like having a compass and probably the most thing is to trust your skill if you're navigating. If you're kind of like winging it, then you're not actually going to believe what it's telling you, and you start like making up all these like it just compounds the problem, because you start trying to believe your places where you're not. And, you know, oh, maybe the compass is broken, or maybe, you know, you often don't, like I once did a ridge in Ireland, and it was just terrible weather. And I thought we were on the, when I thought we were at the summit of the first of the peaks, being like Snowdon Horseshoe kind of thing, we were on like a lower summit. So when we got onto the real summit, I thought it was on the second summit. But when I was like taking a bearing to the next summit, because there wasn't any path in claggy weather, it was pointing in the wrong direction. Every summit was off by something, but I kept just telling myself that the Glencoe and Horseshoe. I kept telling myself that the compass must be broken. You know, rather than just, you know, I was always trying to make everything fit. Like, oh, maybe the map was wrong, or maybe the compass was broken, and you kind of half winging it and stumbling to the next summit, and then that the compass is still off. It's like telling you to go off the edge of a cliff, and you're like, well, I'll just go along the edge of the cliff rather than off it. If you just actually stopped and thought for a minute, like, why is this happening? You know, instead of occurring to you when you think you've got, you think you're going down at the end of the day, and then there's suddenly another summit appears in front of you, then it's only twig what's happened. But often when you're like in a rush and you're a little bit, you know, It's a bit scary when you don't know where you are and you don't really trust the map all of a sudden, and these things all sort of compound each other. So often if you just like all, if you all can stop and just think like, what's going on, what do you think? But then it's often you don't want people to realize that you're a bit lost, really. So having a GPS is probably a great, you know, and knowing how to use it is probably good for those. I'm sure in the olden days, you know, these like roughy tufty people, if they had a GPS, they would have used it. I think even like phones these days have pretty good GPS. Like, I remember, I think once did like a really long walk where we were missing the last 5 inches of the map, and we thought we could just wing it when we got there to find out the way down to the end of this big trek. And when we got there, we just got completely lost, and we had a phone, but when we tried to use it to see where we were, just the battery just died. So then we had no, and then by that point we descended down somewhere where we're going to go backtrack to where we knew we were. So we just ended up having this epic night. So technology is good when it works, but it often doesn't work. So ideally, like I always tell the kids, like, if you ever get lost, always go back to the last place that you saw, you know, you saw each other, you know, your mum and dad, or last place they saw you and you saw them. That was Alan Mullen, when I climbed with Alan Mullen, who had been in the, he was in the army. He always used to say that, meet at the last RV or something. So having all those kind of things is good, but even when everything is perfect, that you always have to realize there's always like a percentage where you're always lost, if you know what I mean. Like, you never really know where you are unless you are literally looking at like a GPS, you know, dot where you're walking around on your phone. You know, you're always going to be a little bit lost for some time, and then you have to just go by intuition. Like, you have to start thinking, I'm walking uphill, you know, the wind is coming from this direction, my senses, I'm walking over here, you know, like suddenly I'm going downhill, or look at the map, or there's like a bit here, there's like a bit of a contour where it goes down, I must be further down the hill than I thought, if I go up this like rib, I'm gonna, you know, blah blah blah. So like the story about going down the hill, and you know, you're seeing a wand. Like, I was once cycling home from work in the Peak District, and it was so foggy that the only way to cycle safely was to cycle in the middle of the road where the middle where the white lines were, and I was basically cycling along from one white line to the other white line, but it was so foggy that sometimes I couldn't make out the next white line, so I was going slower. The slower I went, the more I was it was harder to see the next white line. So sometimes it's like that. Like, you're seeing cairns, or you're seeing wands, or you're seeing various things that you're navigating to, but almost between those two points, you are like totally lost. I think the thing is just not to go blindly on. You know, once you start getting lost, you need to start making some, you know, have a plan for how to, you know, just try and look at the map, look at the contour lines again, try and knowing where you were before will help you know where you are, even if you're lost, if that makes sense. Yeah, like falling over, like, I know lots of people have fallen over cliffs, fallen through bergschrunds. They thought they were somewhere where they weren't. So, you know, if things get bad, then you just have to start pitching it. Like, get the rope out, tie together with each other, even, you know, one person can walk 60 meters to the end of the rope in one direction, follow a bearing, and, you know, blah blah blah, like it's in the story there was a choice where they got to the summit and can either go down the way they came up, which obviously not ideal because it was like very difficult finding the summit, or go down this road, which was a bit of a cop out, but even then it was quite tough, I think. Is you're dead for like a really long, really really long time, and if you don't die, then the amount of I guess if you live through like a bit of a trauma, it's great fun, it's good laugh, but you know, if you've got a choice of going the easy way down off something when it's that bad, rather than just, you know, the easy way could be like almost impossible, so the hard way is going to, you know, you're just going to be luck if you can find your way down there. When you're like winter climbing and you know one of the descents is prone to avalanches and it's hard to find, but it's quick, you know, like, well, maybe just go like the slower way that's easy to find and isn't prone to avalanches, and you know, it might be a longer walk, but you're making a sensible decision, and that's if you make it down, everyone's like, oh god, that guy is so tough, you know, he went down there in that terrible storm and he was that drinking tea and toasting us and we stumbled in like 5 hours later all knackered, but you don't, you know, that's not how you play like a long game. So there's no shame in making the right choices, but there is in making the wrong choices. So often, like, if you think like, what would you have done if things had gone tits up? So Vanessa, when she goes, she often goes running in the mountains and she doesn't take anything with her, and she's like night running, so she'll meet up with like a running club and run up in the mountains in near where we live in Ireland, and the weather's pretty manky, and you know, there's no real paths and stuff, and I'm like, why don't you know, you always have to ask yourself, like, she'll come back and she'll be grey, and she won't have eaten enough when she went out, and then she won't have taken any food, never had any food when she finished. And she should be like grey and like, oh, I feel so sick, I think I've caught something. No, you just got low blood sugar. Like, what did you eat before you went out? Oh, I had like a rice cake with some peanut butter on it. I'm like, no, that's not food. That's like the opposite. That's what you have when you don't want to, you know, you want to have no energy. So, I'm always like saying, like, what would you? It's not about you not stopping. It's like, what if you had to stop? What if you're with somebody and they break their ankle and you have to wait with them? Or, you know, what if you have to give... What if someone doesn't have anything and you have to give them what you have and you have nothing? So trying to think like... the worst case scenario is you have to spend the night out. I once met somebody and they were on a mountain rescue team. And they found these two people who had to spend the night out in Scotland, and they were still alive, but in the process of like trying to get them down the mountain, like one of them just died. Even though they were being rescued, they just still died because it was, you know, they were just so frozen basically. So you're not going to go on the hill with like all your bivy gear and everything else, but you do need to have the stuff to survive if you are in this like, you know, apocalyptic wind whiteout conditions and you get totally lost and it gets totally dark. And sometimes it is just you can either keep on going and just plod and just keep going until eventually you get down, but sometimes you could be so lost, or one of the people you're with is just so cold that it's just not possible unless you just abandon them and just keep on going. So So having the ability, everyone together, to stop where you are is, you know, is kind of important. So, you know, having a bothy bag, you know, like one of those bags everyone can get inside of, having some sort of bivy, you know, some sort of bivy bag, even a plastic bag, you know, one of those reflective blankets, having something to sit on, which is probably more important, you know, the foam in your rucksack and all that kind of stuff, is, you know, all those things are like, you know, vital. Like, how much do you have? Any like, do you have any emergency food? You know, all these kind of things. You know, somewhere to communicate with people to tell them that you're not dying. You're just going to spend the night on the, you know, out or something. You know, being able to. I think if you've never done it, if you ever had like a really really bad weather day, is. If you winter, you know, if you're out in the winter and you have a really bad weather day and you've nothing to do, you want to go out and try making some shelters with the snow. You know, digging a pit, digging a snow hole, digging a you know, various kind of shelters, even like a shelter where you just dig a hole and stick your head into it. So just your top half of your body is like in a hole. You know, dig a trench and put your, try securing your bothy bag over the top of it, and then like cover that in snow. Put your ski poles underneath it. You know, there's various ways of making shelters that could really turn a horrific night that could kill you into just like a horrific night that doesn't kill you. It's like no one's going to be sleeping, that's for sure. But it's a good, you know, it's good sort of training. It gives you, I think, anything that can remove some of the stress and anxiety. Like, stress and anxiety in those situations are more likely to cause you to make the wrong decision. But the more like comfortable you are, you know, if you're like an Inuit, you know that whatever happens, you'd be able to make a shelter and survive the night in a, you know, in a snow hole, or like an igloo or something. So it's the same. Like, if you're confident in your navigation, you're confident in your gear, you're confident in your fitness, you're confident in your ability to deal with if the situation doesn't turn out right, you're confident to deal with if you get lost, you're confident to get down, it's all these things make go from when you have no experience and everything is an epic and like terrifying, to being in a situation that to an outsider looks like an epic, but to you seems quite normal. It's a bit like if you ever like sea kayaking, if you're in the, you know, when you first start sea kayaking, like every little wave that comes underneath you think you're going to fall over, and you see people in tidal races and like amazingly scary sea, but they're totally comfortable. And it's a similar thing. It's because they've got enough experience. They know that if they fall in, they can roll back up again, and they can roll in lots of different ways. And even if they fall out of the kayak, they know to get back into the kayak, and if somebody else falls out, they can rescue them. And they've also spent a lot of time in those kind of conditions, so they're not going to fall out anywhere, and they trust their kayak, and they trust their paddle, and they trust their scale, and this kind of thing. So it's the same with you know, with this kind of thing. And that's why when you go with people more experienced with more experience than you are, you look at them and you're like, wow, this person is like not shitting themselves and why is that? And it's kind of it's not infectious, but you get like a dose of it, if you know what I mean. Like, you'll look back and you think, well, he seemed to be dealing it. But like in your head, you might actually be like, I don't know, there's a bit where you're like monitoring. Like, kids never seem to, they're either not cold or they've got hypothermia. Like, they're walking around, like, my kids walk around with, like, just a nappy on. It's, like, freezing. I'd have all my clothes on. They're walking around with a nappy on. And I'm like, get your clothes on. It's like really cold. And they're like, and they're just not interested. Try and start crying. Put their clothes on. Then the next minute they're like blue and their lips are blue and they're just, you know, like laid on the floor with their legs in the air. So it's the same when you're in the mountains, is that you're much more aware of, I think I might be getting lost here, or I think I might be getting cold here, or I think I might be about to fall off here, where you don't, when you have no experience, it's like, I'm lost, I'm really, really cold, I'm falling off. So as you come towards that line, you get like a sense of it, you know, if you mean, you get like I need to start putting on more clothes here, I need to put more gear in here, I need to look at my map like twice as hard, I need to like doubly concentrate, I need to, you know, check with somebody else, like, I think, where do you think we are? Yeah, I think we're in the same place, and blah blah blah. So whenever you get to a point, the point of oblivion, you're like, you know, you suddenly, you don't, you put your what's the word, you know, you bring your game, whatever it is, you know, you start like concentrating more and you start being better, where, you know, when you're walking down a track in a forest and know exactly where you are, you could be in like La La Land, it doesn't really matter. But when you're you know, on the topping out on a Scottish mountain in the dark in a full-on hurricane and you can't see anywhere, like, that's when you have to be 100% good at what you're doing, and to be able to make the right decisions. And lots of people don't, but most people do. So anyway, so that, I guess that's enough waffling. Hopefully the sound quality is not too bad. Sorry for the interruptions, talking to people about washing and everything else. I'll cut all that out, so you'll never hear it. Anyway, so keep sending me. I've got a few more questions people have asked me, but any more questions, random questions about anything at all, I'm happy to have something to talk about. So until next time, stay safe.